This is Rob Long with Martini Shot for The Ankler. I once had a young writer on a writing staff, and we were talking about when exactly we could expect that writer's first draft. "I'm not sure," she said. "I'll have to figure that out with my assistant." And I remember thinking to myself, assistant? And then mentally calculating this writer's episode and script fees and wondering how someone making such a decent but not extravagant salary justified spending even what was probably a usurious portion of it on an assistant. I mean, what did this assistant assist with? Now, at the time, I was one of the co-executive producers of a network television comedy, and I had a writer's assistant. We had two of them, as a matter of fact. But these are pretty important, busy jobs. They have to make script and story notes and sit during rewrites and get all the changes into the script and, in general, work for the only thing worse than one writer, and that's a room full of writers. But they were busy. They didn't really work for me exclusively or even non-exclusively. They worked for the show. So when the writer said, "I'll have to figure it out with my assistant," I guess I was nonplussed. The actual definition of nonplussed, by the way, which is baffled rather than what it sounds like and will eventually come to mean, which is unimpressed. I mean, I was baffled, and I guess it showed on my face because the writer explained that the assistant was there to help with all sorts of things the writer was too busy for. What those things were unspecified, and that, besides, it was a great way to break into show business, running to CVS and Staples, I guess. And of course, we all know that when you talk to your agent or manager, it's highly likely that his or her assistant is listening in on that call. I mean, they're supposed to, actually. It's considered a perk for some reason, a way to really learn how the entertainment business is conducted. Although it would seem to me that a day spent listening to phone calls between agents and clients and agents and studios couldn't possibly encourage anyone to get into show business, but apparently it does. So the next time you're on the phone with your agent or manager, make sure you say hi to the assistant who's also on the line on mute. Now, I was once running a show, and I was told by the line producer that there was money in the budget for my assistant, should I want one? And I said, I don't need one. And then I thought, well, wait. I mean, maybe I do need one. I mean, everyone in Hollywood has one, right? And they all know each other and follow each other on Instagram and hang out in bars and places like that, exchanging information and getting intel to bring back to the office. I mean, it's true. The town is basically run by a bunch of young people, roughly the same age, who listen in on every single important phone call. I mean, they are the ones who know stuff. And I'm sure I can find something for this person to do, right? I thought to myself. So sure, I said, get me an assistant. So suddenly I had an assistant who was smart and capable, and I'm sure bored out of his mind at my general lack of things for him to do. I mean, I'm sitting with the writers all day, and then sometimes I had to go to the stage or editing, but that's pretty much it. So I felt like I was letting him down. Like, he only took the job because he thought there'd be important stuff to do and juicy phone calls to listen in on, and it turned out he mostly just had to cover for me when I was running late. And a little after that, someone asked if I'd help out on another project, so I said yes, despite the fact that I was already busy and late for everything and kind of stressed out and cranky, but I said yes because I thought I owed it to my assistant to be, you know, really busy and overcommitted. I wanted to look busy for my employee. And maybe that's why anything gets done around here in the entertainment industry. Maybe it's not that we're all involved in passion projects or motivated by a restless creative energy. Maybe we're all just trying to look important to our assistants, trying to keep them busy by looking busy ourselves. Or maybe we're all just pretending to be frantic and stressed out. Because, you know, if we stop calling each other and calling each other back and sending emails and calendar invitations for Zoom calls, maybe we have enough time to create new scripts and projects and ideas rather than reboots and sequels and retreads. And those are scary and risky, so who wants that? A friend of mine once wrote a scene about a guy who gives a woman he's interested in his phone number, but he tells her that he doesn't have voicemail. "No voicemail," she says. "What happens when you get important phone calls?" she asks. "I don't get important phone calls," he says. Which is sort of, you know, funny and charming and a character-revealing line, and it set him up as a lovable but ineffectual kind of a guy, and also someone with a kind of strength and independence not to worry about who might or might not be calling him. But the network hated that line. They just hated it. They simply could not accept that anyone worth talking about, any character worth writing a scene about, wouldn't have voicemail, and worse, wouldn't hang his head in hot, cheek-burning shame that he didn't get important phone calls. And apparently this discussion went on for hours. "You cannot say this about someone you want the audience to like," they told the writer. "You cannot have a character in your show who does not get important phone calls and is proud of it." "Why?" he kept asking the network executives. "Because a person who doesn't get important phone calls," they told him with trembling and emotional voices, "is a loser, is a failure, is a nobody, is deeply unlikable." Now, I am not a licensed psychiatrist, of course, but I do know projecting when I see it. Getting important phone calls and having meetings, being a certain kind of frazzled busy, that's one of the chief badges of importance for a lot of people in this business. "Sorry," they'll say breathlessly as they arrive late for something I was on the phone with, and then they'll name their immediate boss, or better, their boss's boss, and they'll slowly stop hyperventilating from the emotional and physical high of the important Zoom or whatever. So the specter of a character who doesn't get important phone calls carries with it the threat of, you know, threat of contagion, like just putting it out there, just articulating the thought that some people just don't get important phone calls. That might actually, you know, create that reality. It might rub off on the senior vice president of current programming scripted. I mean, it's enough to send some executives into fits. "Get that line out of there," they say, with the kind of purposeful seriousness people use when they squirt antibacterial gel in their hands and rub the disease away. So it's no use trying to explain that getting important phone calls really isn't all that meaningful, that most phone calls aren't important anyway, just like most meetings and emails and Zooms are just pointless buck passing and time wasting. That we create an awful lot of turbulence for each other in this business when we do not have to. That the beehive of hyperactive emails and 7 p.m. conference calls really don't make a project, whatever project, any better. Just noisier. Makes us feel busier, more important. Like we're less at the mercy of a lot of randomly moving parts that may or may not add up to anything or give our project a green light or deliver a hit TV show. But of course we are. Though if people are calling you and they're important, then it means you're important too. And for a lot of people, that's enough. So look, patterns are hard to break. So here's my solution. Tomorrow, let's everyone in the entertainment business randomly call someone else in the entertainment business and leave this message. Urgent. Please call. ASAP. And then let's agree just not to return that call. And the next day, we'll pick another random name and repeat until everyone has made and received a bunch of important phone calls. And then we can all get back to the actual task before us in 2024, the mission statement of all of show business, which is just to make thrillers that are thrilling, comedies that are funny and touching, coming-of-age dramas. Well, let's not make any more of those. But patterns, in other words, are very hard to break. But it seems to me that most of the recent economic and growth news out of Hollywood is bad, so it might make sense to break as many of the old patterns of doing business as we can. Maybe the best way to reboot show business is to do whatever the opposite of our current instincts is. Maybe it's time to throw the baby out with the bathwater and, you know, just get another baby, get a fresh baby. A baby that is not a version of an old baby or a previously live-action, now animated baby or a Marvel baby or a Nepo baby of a previous baby. I think maybe secretly we're all a little worried that we've lost that ability in all of show business to find ourselves a new baby or even recognize a new baby when we see it. And that makes sense because, of course, patterns are hard to break. Like a few years ago, I went on a container ship from Seattle to Shanghai. I mean, to be clear, I was not in one of the containers. I was a passenger traveling in one of the small unoccupied cabins. And I ate meals at a large table with the officers who were mostly German or Polish. And I spent my mornings walking the length of the ship and my afternoons smoking cigars on the railing. And the nights I spent looking upward, awestruck by the canopy of stars. And when you see the night sky as the ancients saw it, brilliantly lit, undimmed by city lights, all the old myths and legends suddenly seem very immediate. Ursa Major really does look like a bear. My theory was that without the usual distractions of phone calls and emails and internet and social media and all that, the productivity-killing quartet that we all struggle against, that I would get some real work done. Instead, I discovered that I'm pretty capable of spending 2 weeks doing nothing at all. I mean, I stared out at the mighty Pacific and I watched whales. I saw zillions of them, so don't let anybody tell you they're in danger. There are tons of whales out there. And I was hypnotized by the sight of snowflakes falling on the ocean waves. There were squalls and swells, and there's just something really powerfully affecting about looking out at the unbroken horizon and tracing the curvature of the earth with your cigar. Now, all of this inactivity was punctuated, of course, by meals. A person who does nothing but stare moodily out at the ocean is clinically depressed, but a person who does that but also stops for meals is just lazy. It was a 10-day journey that turned into a 3-week journey, but thanks to bad weather and a cyclical economy, by the time we got to our first port of call, Busan, Korea, we had been at sea for about 2 weeks, which meant 2 weeks of me staring at the ocean, eating, staring at the ocean, eating, staring at the ocean, and eating. So you'd think that pulling into the busy and vaguely exotic port city of Busan, South Korea, would be like a prison break. The ship was set to depart at night, and I was supposed to be back aboard by 9 p.m., and that gave me the entire day to wander freely around a, to me, unknown city. And yet, before I disembarked, the sign on the galley door said, "Tonight, pizza night." Now, I knew from the weeks before what that meant because the menus rotated in a fairly tight cycle, repeating every 3 days or so. So pizza night was a frozen disc of dough reheated to just soft, topped with a sauce that the next day would be spaghetti sauce, little sausage from breakfast, and a weirdly indistinct cheese, I hope cheese. Busan, of course, the go-getting port city that it is, the film festival city that it is, has a lot of pizza places, both Korean and not. If I wanted pizza, pizza was available on dry land. If I wanted Korean or Chinese or Italian or a hamburger, Busan was the place. Busan offered fresh bread and steak and ice cream and cocktail bars and sugary pastries and salad greens, still crisp, vegetables, not from a can. But as I walked around the city, I kept thinking, well, tonight is pizza night. Better get back for pizza night. And before I knew it, I was heading back to the ship early, hours early, because I didn't want to miss pizza night, even though the pizza was revolting. Now, what was it that made me want to stop wandering around an interesting city and check back into prison? Made me want to give up my freedom to eat a meal I didn't expect to enjoy just because that was my habit for the previous 2 weeks? When people ask me what it was like to be on a container ship, I always tell them about the whales and the sky and the snowfall, but I also include my inexplicable and shameful need to turn away from an interesting and cosmopolitan city to hurry back to the ship in time for a wad of spongy dough basted in ketchup. Now, a lot of people I've discovered can relate to that. Most of us have a pizza night in our lives. Maybe it's a job or a person or a bad habit we really don't enjoy but keep hurrying back to. Maybe it's voicemail or Zoom calls. Maybe it's just the patterns of doing business in show business. They say that when prisoners are released from jail, as they walk away from the building, they always look back. And it's hard to walk away from pizza night, but sometimes the thing to do is just throw out the pizza with the pizza box to wake up tomorrow and do everything differently, even though it's scary. And that's it for this week. Next week, we miss something. For The Ankler, this is Rob Long with Martini Shot.